Good evening. This is Catherine Austin Fitz, and we're having a discussion this evening about Solaria investment strategy. I wanted to describe this and discuss it with you in anticipation of the event that John Rappaport and Joseph Farrell and I are doing in November in California. The purpose of my life was to try and figure this out. And then to, having once figured out the basic construct, try and apply it. And if you look at everything I do, that's what has led me to where I am now. And I still continue to try to understand how best to apply it. And one of my goals with this event is to help you access it as a tool to use to the extent that it's useful for you. It is essential that all of these things be useful in a practical way to anybody who picks them up and tries to use them. So let me just start by explaining what Solaria investment strategy is. Think of this as something that can be applied to institutional investment capital in the billions or trillions, but it also can be applied to the application of time and money in your life. It's really, if anything, a protocol, a habit, an approach, a way of using intelligence to continuously learn and optimize. The challenge has always been, from the time I was a very young person, I always could never fathom why people were running around making money doing things that sort of destroyed other people or destroyed places or living things. It seemed to me we needed a cosmology to align people and places with the financial system to build wealth. I never thought of it as an either or. It seemed to me that money was a version of people's energy traded through time and space. And so it was just another form of human energy. And so it seemed to me the idea of aligning financial energy and living energy was perfectly logical and a way to build wealth. And in fact, later, many years later, I was able to prove that if you could do it, the wealth that can be created is quite mind-boggling. Sometimes the way I will explain this is to describe the Popsicle Index and the S&P Index. The Popsicle Index is the percent of people in a place who believe a child can leave their home, go to the nearest place and buy a Popsicle. And then, of course, the S&P Index is one of the indicators for the U.S. domestic stock market. And throughout my lifetime, the Popsicle Index, a.k.a. human or living capital, has gone down, down, down. And the S&P Index has gone up, up, up. And it's been a win-lose relationship between the two. And it is perfectly plausible to engineer the financial system. And so, in fact, they have a win-win relationship. So they go up together or down together. It's perfectly feasible. Let me just describe Solaria investment strategy in a nutshell, then go back and explain it in much greater detail in the application, and then I'll come back and describe it in a nutshell again. Imagine any investment, whether it's an investment of billions of dollars or an investment of your time and effort. Every investment has a total economic return. There's the return to you, the investor, but there's also the return of the impact on the ecosystem in which the investment happens. So I call that the return to the network. So, for example, let's say we build a convention center in a town and the investors put the money up and they get a return over time. And then there's an impact on the municipality and the local economy, which can be positive or negative. And so we call that the return to the network. So the two of them together, the return to the investor, the return to the network, is the total economic return. Solaria investment strategy says, number one, take the time to understand the impact of your investments on the network and other players involved. So clearly a lot of that is understanding and estimation. There's no perfect science necessarily. Then Solaria investment strategy says, okay, after you've taken the time to understand and to estimate, use that knowledge to identify opportunities and risks, and then optimize your own return. So use that information to help you find opportunities, to exploit opportunities, and to avoid risk. And then there's a final rule, which is under no circumstances, never intentionally proceed to affect an investment that has a negative return to either the investor or the network. So you're trying to play what I call net energy plus, which is you are looking for opportunities to create energy for yourself in a way that make the pie bigger. And if you can't, you don't. So again, never intentionally do anything that has a negative return, or certainly has the intention of a negative return, whether to you as the investor or the network. Now, clearly you're going to do things that add value to the network, and it's not, there's going to be creative destruction. Not everybody's going to be a winner. So I'm not saying that it's not going to have negative implications for some people. And part of being awake and making sure you understand the impact on the different players involved in the network is that's part of being awake and helping you identify risk. So one of the ways I say this very simply is just play net energy plus. Now, there are two changes from the traditional money management philosophy. When I went to Wharton Business School, went to Wall Street, our goal was to optimize the return to the investor. It was pretty much, we didn't worry about what the impact of the investment was other than sort of the political implications, or clearly we were intending in all the overt cases to be above the law. But basically we took the position it was government's responsibility to take care of making sure the total economic return was positive, and we just looked for opportunities to make opportunities for the to optimize the return on investors. So one of the changes is take the time to invest in the knowledge management, the analytics you need to understand and estimate the impact of what you're having investments. It used to drive me crazy to go to a mutual fund or a big institutional investor and see them making an investment with one part of the portfolio that was destroying the value and causing a negative return to an investment they'd made in another part of the portfolio, and they didn't even see it and know it. There was sort of multiple personality disorder that was lowering returns across the portfolio. So the first difference from traditional money management is increasing investment in that kind of knowledge management analytics. And I think as time has gone by, you're seeing that happen with the big investors. The second is agree not to do something that has a negative return to the network. So I'm always having people coming to me and saying, look, there's a great opportunity, let's buy Monsanto. And I'm saying, no, the answer is no. I have no interest in financing my death, the death of the planet, the death of the people around me. So the answer is no. I'm not going to do that. So that is the second of the sort of additional changes. But in all other respects, it's the very same, looking to optimize. Now, I want to talk a little bit about how I really got interested to do this, because I got interested in a very young age. I figured I needed to know how all the money in the planet worked. My goal was really to understand how the money in a community worked. I didn't realize that to understand one community, I had to understand the economy of the whole planet, but so it was. And I proceeded to go to business school, go to Wall Street, and move from department to department around the firm trying to map out the different aspects of the markets. And I finally realized, oh, this is all rigged from Washington. So I ended up going to Washington and working in an agency that would give me access to data on all 3,100 counties in America, so I could really dig in and see what was happening economically. And in fact, after I left the Bush administration and started Hamilton, we won a contract to be portfolio strategy, a strategist and financial advisor to the Federal Housing Administration. And again, one of the reasons was I could get my hands on all the data, which was invaluable. But I came out of I left Wall Street, went to Washington, worked in the Bush administration, and left the Bush administration convinced that digital technology was unbelievably powerful, and you were watching a group of people take that technology and use it to centralize control in a way that was enormously destructive. And I truly believed at the time that what was needed was decentralization, but decentralization that was exceptionally wealth building. And I saw the new digital technology as an opportunity to really help me finish figuring out mapping how all the money works and finding a way that with market-based economies where people are basically free to do what they want within certain limits, the limits being the law that we covenant and agree to, that they would be free to optimize. So the question was, how can we take this technology and do something centralizing with respect to the different aspects of the financial system? The ones I was focused on was currency, equity, debt, and then all the issues of privacy and transparency and the integrity of the systems you're using, including now the digital systems. That integrity is more and more important as we can see. So when I left the Bush administration, I started an investment bank and financial software developer named Hamilton Securities. And part of what I was trying to do was we were building relational databases sufficient to really understand and see what was happening economically in the domestic economy, so looking at things by county. And, of course, we had the opportunity as the portfolio strategist, FHA, to look at all the housing and real estate, which was critical to really understanding local economies. Hamilton Securities was named after Alexander Hamilton. I'm a great admirer of Alexander Hamilton, who was the first Secretary of the Treasury. And one of the things that Hamilton did when he became Secretary of the Treasury is he established the group at Treasury that determined standards and codes. He was very clear that if you're going to have a successful economy, you need to have standards and codes for all sorts of things. They're the protocols that make things go. You certainly see in the IT and software area the importance of having agreed upon standard and codes to make things go. And really, when I was digging in and looking at the money, I was looking for something very simple, some simple protocols that if we could all play according to those protocols, we could really unleash the power of aligning living equity with financial equity. It's got to be simple. It's got to be basic. Anyway, I went to work, and one of the things I did was we looked at ways of optimizing the place-based economy. And one of the things I discovered was the real challenge, the real holdup, or one of the real holdups in the domestic economy was the government money was being invested. It had a negative return to the taxpayer and a negative return to the network, but it was making a lot of money for certain investors. So the government money was really being engineered to kind of rig things in certain ways and to make sure certain people controlled. But it certainly wasn't optimized by any kind of criteria, and that was more than anything what had the economy bollocksed. I'm going to talk a little bit more later about how covert operations relates to that. But the reality was one of our subsidiaries was working with a group of pension fund managers. And I came to realize after looking at tremendous amounts of institutional capital and data that we collected on institutional capital that we really didn't need to worry investment capital with things like socially responsible investment. It was really a complete waste of investment capital's time. What we needed was transparency, enough transparency, whether knowledge management within an institution so it could assess total economic return and return to the network for the purposes of identifying opportunities and avoiding risk. But the other thing is I realized for markets to work, you absolutely need to have sufficient transparency so that players can identify and avoid dirty players. One of the most life-changing experiences during that period was reading Axelrod's book, The Evolution of Cooperation, where he talks about the fact that with transparency, you can build an economy that leads you to peace instead of to war. The reality is one of the most powerful tools in any marketplace or culture society is the power of shunning. And players can't and won't be shunned if they can continue to be socially acceptable despite being very dirty actors. And this gets back to something you've heard me talk about often enough called the ability to kill with impunity. We have too many players in the society who can kill with impunity and turn around and be considered socially acceptable. So the absence of transparency and the government investment being invested on a negative return on investors to taxpayers that you could only see with place-based transparency, and you could only begin to change that around with place place-based transparency. So we needed transparencies to address sort of how to illuminate and shift dirty players, as well as how to illuminate and shift government money back to a positive return. And those two, you know, is that negative return that was financing lots of dirty players. Finally, another book that I discovered, another sort of whole body of knowledge I discovered, was Rupert Sheldrake's theory of morphogenic fields, which was the first time I got any kind of theory that would explain the kind of economic optimization I was seeing. Optimization occurs not around return on investment in the financial sense. It optimizes around cohorts of shared intelligence. It's much more of an energetic phenomena, and it needs to be understood that way. It's Peter Drucker's done a lot of talking and thinking about what it means for an economy to be an information economy, but we're talking about an economy where the economics are really being changed by the learning metabolism and the ability to organize, gather, and share intelligence. So part of it was getting a theory that would help me explain that. And then finally, at the time, we were going through, as a society, enormous shifts in both how the currency operated and how equity and debt flows operated, with the changes that came with the Uruguay round of GATT and the shift to rebalance the global economy. So as I talked with the leadership at OMB about reengineering government money, or I talked with pension fund leaders about institutional capital, one of the things I realized, and we'd been very interested when we started Hamilton, okay, how do we bring this down to a community? Because the opportunity for the pension funds at the time was if we could reengineer community, the government investment within a community, and turn it around, there would be enormous increase in equity valuations. And if the pension funds could capture that enormous increase in equity valuations, then it would help them make their targets for investment for the retirement of the baby boomers. And so we started to dig in and say, okay, well, what does this mean to municipal finance? What does this mean to local and venture capital? And started to work on local and venture funds. And I've written a great deal about the what I call the Solari stock model, which is the A share, B share model, and local venture funds, how to use the Solari stock model to finance businesses or a venture fund. I'm not going to go in that today. There's a lot of information up on the blog, and I'm delighted to do that at some point. What I discovered, of course, was the big enforcement question, which is, you at the time, you had big investors moving into those communities and dealing drugs into those communities, using that money to finance much greater presence of big corporations through franchises and big box stores. And the last thing they wanted was the locals having access, you know, through aggregations like the kinds that I was prototyping in Hamilton, to compete with them. They wanted a full rein to suck up all the capital and use that capital to buy the market. And of course, they had the ability to bring about dirty tricks or to kill, as I said, kill with impunity. And the question was, you know, we can have all the fancy financial engineering we want with venture funds and stock models, but if some people have the ability to kill with impunity, it doesn't matter what you have in your bylaws and operating agreements, everybody's going to do what the, you know, the guy with the gun says. So it was when I ran into the serious litigation at Hamilton, that was when I started to dig in and look at all the covert issues, covert operations, which as a practical matter, we have to deal with. We have to live in a world where these things go in. And so I dug in and researched all the issues about the compromise of our digital and other systems, our financial systems, control files, why the derivatives were such an obstacle to sort of healthy changing of the financial system, because derivatives really commit, a small group of players can get together and commit enormous amounts that basically lock the future into going into certain directions. And it really takes away the flexibility and the power of the marketplace. And then, of course, all the issues on the rebalancing of the global economy and the organized crime that we talk about on the Solari report. And then finally, the technology kept getting more and more powerful. And of course, you know, out comes smartphones and So now in the rebalancing of the global economy, we literally are approaching a world where all 7 billion people can contact, communicate, and transact with each other in very intimate ways. So it powers up the learning speeds, you know, to an exponential factor. Anyway, so as I went through all of those, I finally realized, look, we need a way to, if you look at the forces we're up against and their ability to watch us through their one-way mirror, but us not see them, the control they have of government money, the control they have of dirty tricks, et cetera, et cetera. We need a way of going about this, which is much more sneaky. And so first and foremost, I came up with the idea of coming clean, which is, look, let me just do what I can do in my own life to get the parasites out and to build up my own, you know, power, whether it's financial or health or anything else. And then I realized, well, to the extent that we want to conspire together, I'm very big on conspiracies, we need to start to take action in the form of circles. And the reason I came up with circles is I think it's very important whenever we decide to organize to take action to do things that give each one of us and our allies practical energy. So a circle can get together and take action together. So they could do a food club together, or they could just watch movies and help each other understand what's going on. There are many different kinds of financially related actions we can take. Circle can also do investment. It can do local investment, or it can do securities investments. I'm now on just beginning my second circle. I did one for 7 years. We did a online brokerage account together. So there are many different things we can do, but the advantage of doing it in a small circle is, let's say 20 circles farm in a county. They can come together deal by deal. They can come together in very organic ways. If the integrity of a circle is harmed for any particular reason, it doesn't blow up the integrity of the whole venture, because you have a syndicate of circles, and that means a small number of people can underwrite each other and trust each other. They don't have to trust everybody in the syndicate, because the syndicate only comes together on an ad hoc basis to do all sorts of things, and it creates a sort of, if you will, a network of conspiracies within a place that are much safer and more manageable for the people who are engaging with them. So I finally came down to sort of coming clean and doing circles. And as we built the Solari report and I started to do investment advisory work, the investment advisory work helped me grapple with the different issues people had in applying these principles of the Solari investment strategy to their investments. And so that has been quite an education, because in fact, if you look at how the economy is managed at every turn, an individual investor is sort of very much encouraged to flow their money into the pro-centralization systems in a way that sort of make the matrix ever more powerful and make us weaker. And the question is, how can we shift our capital, but shift our capital in a way, again, that optimizes our return to investors? And it's not easy. One of the things I'll say is the more of us who do it, the more possible it is. And of course, if we can build enough people coming clean or organizing to take action and do, you know, whether you want to call them circles or conspiracies, it the word doesn't really matter so much as learning how to organize to gather power, whether for ourselves or for the people we choose to cooperate with. If we can get enough traction there, then of course you can start to really shift at much higher levels of the financial system. So if you get enough critical mass in a place, you can start to really do amazing things to re-engineer the local economy, including the local government money. And I think as the economy evolves here, that opportunity is going to be among us. If you look at the 90s, one of the oppositions was capital was being shifted out. Now that capital has been shifted out, there's going to be more pressure to re-engineer and optimize what is. So I think in an interesting kind of way, we have a new opening available to try and do some of these things. And that's one of the reasons that I wanted to be part of getting together in November and talking about these things. So let me go back to the Solari investment strategy in a nutshell. What I said again before is any investment in whether it's an investment of your time or investment of your money, has a return. It has a return to you, the investor. It has a return to the network in combination. I call both of them the total economic return. Take the time to understand the impact of investments on the network and the players around you, and use that information to identify opportunities and risks. And with that information, optimize your return to an investor. One of the ways you do that, in fact, is looking for ways to align with others. And so you're always trying to play in a way that you don't intentionally have a negative return to investor or others. You know, so when people begin to understand that you take responsibility to understand their wants, their needs, and you always try and align in a way that creates value for them and creates value for you. Again, I call it net energy plus. The power of sort of playing this way is the more you hold to doing that with integrity, the more people trust you, and the more they look to align with you, the more they count on you to play that way. Surround yourself with many allies who all know how to play net energy plus. Then you're talking about respecting each other's time and respecting each other's needs. And as that trust grows, you start to get something done. A couple things I see as people try and apply these kind of protocols is I think it's important to understand that it's not, I believe very strongly, it's not my place to judge somebody else's purpose. In other words, my philosophy is that you and our creator have a purpose for your life, and that's between you and the creator. It's not my mind to judge. I'm here to help you achieve it, unless I find it to be lawless or unethical, at which point I will simply avoid you. But I'm not here to judge you or tell you what you ought to be doing. What I try and do is take the time to listen to what you want to get accomplished and what you care about. It's part of taking the time, the knowledge management, to understand the impact of things around you. And then I look for a way to align with your efforts so that I can work with you and collaborate with you in a way that gives you energy in a way that gets me energy. So again, net energy plus. If there is no way to align with you in a way that'll give me energy, then out the door I go. And of course, if there's a way I can align with someone else, spend that time align with somebody else that'll give me a lot more energy, then I'll go over there. Again, net energy plus. Now, these are protocols that can be applied to every aspect of your life. Part of this is taking personal responsibility to understand that I'm responsible to create and build my world. The way I can solve any problem is by owning it. So whether it's fair or not, I take responsibility for it. And that in the process, there's nothing more valuable than integrity and excellence. Those are very high goals. I certainly don't always achieve them. I strive for them, but there's always an endless opportunity for improvement. But they are standards that, if can be established, attract lots of allies and attract a lot of feasibility to get things done. And especially because really great conspiracies don't, you know, we agree to do something. If we can trust that we will either do it or communicate, wow, a lot can happen. Because there is law, because there's law that we create and maintain in the way that we conduct with each other. So these protocols can work with your intention and your imagination. They can work with your time. There's nothing more important than the investment of your time. They can work with your associations. One of the critical issues is, how do I operate with respect towards others? How do I operate so others respect me? How can I understand others' needs? How can I achieve all sorts of different kinds of communication across cultural or age barriers or language barriers, how can I organize to successfully conspire in circles or other mechanisms? But probably the most important thing is, how can I know who it makes sense to associate with and who I can trust? I find that good underwriting and good due diligence of people is extremely important. And then all these protocols can apply to your resources, how you work, how you practice entrepreneurship, personal finance. You can apply them to investments, although there's an awful lot of gray area given how much the matrix is done to sort of lock things down. But there still is opportunity. Of course, this always takes you into risk issues. There are enormous amounts of traps, and I tend to spend a lot of time on the Solari Report talking about traps like entrainment and mind control, because I find that so many efforts are sabotaged because most people are not trained to see and avoid those things or identify and deal with them. And where we as individuals and then as small groups can get really sophisticated and effective at doing that, pow, it makes an enormous difference. There are two stories I always tell that help me kind of communicate the Solari investment strategy. One is the story of Gideon, which is my favorite story from the Bible. It's in Judges chapter 6 through 9. Gideon is a shepherd in Israel, and the angel of the Lord comes to him and says, Gideon, we want you to throw the Midianites out of Israel. And Gideon says, you must be kidding. You know, the Midianites have an army, and I'm a shepherd. I'm the last guy in the last family, you know, in the last tribe in Israel. I can't possibly do that. And the angel of the Lord says, no, the Lord's going to do it. You don't have to do it. You just call for the army. So he does. He gets a whole bunch of people who show up, and the angel of the Lord comes back and says, well, you know, they're not all faithful. You need to tell the ones who are not faithful to go home. Well, Gideon's apoplectic because he says, how am I going to throw the Midianites out with just a few people and if I'm sending them home? So needless to say, he sends home the scared guys, and then the angel of the Lord comes back and says, well, Gideon, you're down to faithful people, but they're not all competent. And so Gideon has to put them through another test, and most of his guys go home, and he's left with 300 soldiers up against this enormous army of the Midianites. Needless to say, Gideon wins. But the idea, the lesson of the story, is that the divine intelligence needs to work through a critical mass of people who share faithfulness and share competency. And I've seen that so many times. It's pretty hard to communicate, but it's if you can build this kind of great trust that comes when people have enormous integrity and are also competent, whatever they've been called to do or are doing together, you get a force multiplier, which is quite remarkable. And so I do think that the divine intelligence works through groups who can come together and literally create that kind of accord. There's a great passage in scripture that says, where two or more are gathered in my name, there am I. And the power of accord. And Gideon is a story, first and foremost, about building a powerful field where people are in accord. And then that's when the magic can happen. The second story is a story that's up on the blog under the title Karma Means You Don't Get Away With Anything. And it's a story from Jung, the psychoanalyst, who had a patient come and visit him who was from the upper reaches of society, according to her dress, he said. And she explained to Jung that she wasn't going to give him her name. She was only going to see him once. She was going to tell him a story and hope that it would clear and help her situation. And here was her story. As a young woman, she had fallen in love with her best friend's husband, and to reconcile the tension, she had murdered her best friend. Being trained as a doctor, she knew how to do it, and she got away with it. Unfortunately for her, from the time she got away with it, everything went wrong. She married the husband and got pregnant, but the husband died shortly after they were married. Her daughter was born, and as soon as she was old enough to get away, took off. She was an accomplished The woman was an accomplished horsewoman. Her horses started to rear and buck, and she had to give up riding. She had beautiful wolfhounds. They died. And one of the things she said to Jung, she said, wherever she was, the birds would stop singing. She told Jung the birds knew. And, you know, I always tell people, if you want to know what's wrong with America, is, you know, wherever you are and whatever community you are and whatever business you are, the birds know. And that's part of what has to be dealt with if we're going to turn things around. You know, it's about the energy that comes from the field being clear, coherent, and clean. So two stories that kind of speak to the power of what can happen when we're all functioning with that kind of investment strategy. Finally, I just wanted to say a word about faith. I've lived for many, many years now in a situation where repeatedly things looked absolutely hopeless. During the litigation, there were so many times that I was framed and I suspect somebody had given the order to kill me. And yet the frame didn't work, the kill didn't work, all sorts of things that were supposed to work to my harm worked for my good. And one of the things I've learned is to stop worrying about whether any of this works or not, but to simply continue on the path doing the very best that I can do and then see what gathers. Because we're in a situation where I always say that if you read the Bill of Rights, you know, our authority comes to us, our power comes to us on divine authority, but the good creator never sent an enforcement capacity we can trust. So we're going to have to do that, and we're going to have to do it on an out-of-control basis. Again, we're going into an economy where 7 people are going to have smartphones and going to be able to communicate with each other, and there's going to be all sorts of covert and games and entrainment going on. But it's going to come down to the power of our ability to conduct ourselves in the way that we would, you know, to treat others the way we would like to be treated, and to find and ally with people who are willing to respect that same protocol. So, but it is essential if we do this, and as we decentralize power, that we create wealth, because if there's anything going on this planet, is wealth is being destroyed. A great deal of real wealth has been destroyed. And so it is essential that we adopt protocols where we respect each other's time and resources and always try and align in a way that increases opportunity and even finds opportunity targeting those who are creating risk. So it can be done, particularly with sufficient transparency. One of the reasons we're doing the event in November that I'm so looking forward to is a lot of what we need to talk about is how. How do I do this? How do I do that? I was talking to one of the people who's going to be involved in the leadership group, and I said to him, you know, Chuck, from the time that you got hit by the smite button till you figured out how to navigate the world and what was really going on, how long did that take you? And he said, 15 years. And I said, imagine if we could create a toolkit that would help people do it in a year, to shrink that 15 years down to a year that was as pleasant and least painful as possible. Wow, that would be great. So we'll be gathering in November and we'll be talking about how. And I really look forward to the next part of the conversation with you.